Hello, my name is Philip Miritan, and today we are going to have a conversation beyond science and religion.
Breaking new ground in thinking, exploring the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, unhindered by common beliefs and perceptions. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion, taking on subjects from the Big Bang, the multiverse, and evolution to the supernatural and the new rising consciousness. This is where scientists, philosophers, New Agers, and spiritualists come together to discuss where this world may be heading. Now, here's your host, lawyer, philosopher, and the author of The Heaven at the End of Science, Philip Miritan.
Now, the purpose of this show is to explore the outer limits of what we know about the world and ourselves, to bring the big questions down to earth. On today's show, we are going to confront a very big question, which is, how did it all begin? Now, if you ask most people this question, a good proportion of them would say, well, it began with the Big Bang. And then we probably have a large number of other people who would say something like, well, God did it, read the book of Genesis. But with regard to the scientific explanation, the leading theory of how it all began is called the Big Bang. But it turns out, I think, that almost the same number of people who would answer the question, the Big Bang started all, would also say that they don't understand what the Big Bang is. We tend to rely upon experts in this field to answer questions like how it all began, in part because the questions are technical, deep, and require a lot of education. So we accept the answers from the professors, and we file them away, and we simply do not delve deeper. Today, however, we are going to delve deeper, and we're lucky to have as our guest an expert in the area of the Big Bang, and specifically the inflationary Big Bang, which is the topic of the show. Our guest today is Paul Steinhardt. Now, Paul Steinhardt is the Albert Einstein Professor of Science at Princeton University and a professor of theoretical physics. He received his Bachelor's of Science at the California Institute of Technology and his PhD in physics at Harvard. He is currently the director of the Princeton Center for Theoretical Science. He's a member of the National Academy of Science and received the Paul Dirac Award from the International Center for Theoretical Physics in 2002 for his contribution to inflationary theory. Now, for today's show, it's also important to put into our background context that Paul Steinhardt is the author of two significant articles on the inflationary theory published in Scientific American over the past 27 years. One article is entitled The Inflationary Big Bang, which was published in the May 1984 issue of Scientific American. Now, Paul co-authored this article with Alan Guth, who's widely considered to be the originator of the inflationary Big Bang model. The second article Professor Steinhardt published 27 years later in the April 2011 edition of Scientific American, and this article is entitled The Inflation Debate: Is the Theory at the Heart of Modern Cosmology Deeply Flawed? Professor Steinhardt is also the author of a book called Endless Universe Beyond the Big Bang that he co-wrote with Neil Turok, which is available, I'm sure, nationwide and also on Amazon.com. Welcome to the show, Professor. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Philip. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so let's start in the beginning. What is the Big Bang Theory?
Okay. Well, the Big Bang Theory, if you were to ask most physicists and cosmologists and astrophysicists, is simply the idea that the universe has been expanding and cooling over time. So that going back in time, the universe was hotter and denser, and going forward in time, it's been expanding and cooling. And as that's been happening, as the temperature of the universe has been changing, it's been going through different stages of evolution, beginning with a stage where it was very hot, so hot that it was boiled into its elemental constituents, and then those constituents formed the first nuclei, first atoms, first molecules, later on the first stars and galaxies, and here we are 13.7 billion years later during this process. So that's the essence of the Big Bang Theory.
Now, I need to ask you, with regard to the Big Bang Theory, what I read is appears to be two schools of thought with regard to this whole creation question. And this is just something to see where you sit on this question, which is some folks, and I think you said it in your original 1984 article, say that the Big Bang is really a theory that goes back to what the Planck's time, or the first 10 to the minus 45th second, or some period just after the what some people would call creation. Then there's some folks, and I think Lawrence Krauss, and there's a bunch of other people now who are following this quantum fluctuation approach, where they think that they could unwind the theory of the Big Bang all the way back to what some people would call nothing. So are you of the school of thought that the Big Bang is really the story of the universe when this first mystery, after this first mysterious appearance of matter and energy appears, or are you of the Lawrence Krauss crowd, or are you neither of them?
That's a very good question, because there's a lot of confusion when you ask scientists about the Big Bang Theory. They often respond to that question, what do you think about that theory, in a way that when they respond to that question, they don't have in mind the same thing as the question that most people are asking. So most people are asking about the moment of creation, whereas when you asked me the question, I very carefully defined the theory. I didn't mention anything about the beginning.
Right.
So I mentioned the idea that the universe was once hotter and denser and has been expanding and cooling. That's the part of the theory which is under very good control, in the sense that we have overwhelmingly redundant tests of that idea, that it was once hotter and has been cooling, hotter and denser and has been cooling. And the equations that describe that process for a long period, going back quite a ways, are under very good control, overwhelmingly tested and confirmed. But when you stretch it back to the point, when you stretch things back farther and farther, using the same equations, going beyond what you can actually observationally test, you eventually reach a point where the equations would tell you that the temperature and density become infinite. This is what people refer to as the Big Bang, or if they think about a creation moment, this would be the moment of creation.
Right.
Now, but now we're pushing the theory or the equations back to a realm where we have no reason to trust them. We don't have independent evidence that they should be trusted. In fact, we're pretty sure that due to the effects of quantum physics, that they are going to have to be significant modifications. At this point, there's room for doubt, question, and alternative theories. And a lot of the interest and moment in cosmology is in exploring different alternative ideas of what might have occurred then. Was it truly a beginning, an emergence from some sort of quantum beginning, or could it be something else? Could there have been a bounce in some sort of pre-Big Bang phase? Both those ideas are very much alive at present. That part we're less sure of. So if you ask astrophysicists, do you believe in the Big Bang Theory, they'll immediately respond yes, because they have in mind this idea of expansion and cooling. But what the audience usually means is, do you believe there was this moment of creation? And if you ask them that question point blank, you'll usually get most scientists saying, well, I might have my favorite idea, but there's room for alternatives.
Yes, yes. I know in your original 1984 article, which, by the way, for those listening, is also published in a Scientific American book called Particle Physics and the Cosmos, and I'm sure it's been published all over the place, Professor, as you know more than I do. But in any event, in your article, you say, for example, the instant of creation remains unexplained, and so that's where I thought you were heading, and what you just said reinforces my belief that, again, the Big Bang is really a theory that takes science from this primordial beginning almost at the beginning of it all But if you rewind the film to point zero, there's mystery there. Is that accurate?
Yes, and you can think of it as very analogous to trying to understand the evolution of life.
Okay.
So we observe life at present. We have fossil evidence of what it was like in the past. And using that evidence, we're able to build up a clearer and clearer picture of that evolutionary story.
Right.
But if you ask exactly how life originated, there's lots of room for speculation, because there we don't have the direct observational evidence or experimental evidence to answer the question. In a similar way, you should think of us as building the story of the history of the universe backwards in time, and using, first of all, nearby observations, then intermediate observations, and then more distant observations, which give us information about the universe at different time periods, because the light had to be emitted at different times to get to us. We're able to then reconstruct the history of the universe going farther and farther back in time, but there reaches a limit to that, and then beyond that, there's now room for alternative possibilities.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite descriptions of this issue is in George Gamow's little book called The Creation of the Universe, which somehow I managed to get an original version of that book, probably at a used bookstore somewhere. But when that book came out, in the second edition, he mentions that he got some criticism from some theologians or from some religious folks about the use of the word creation in the title. And he in the note to the second edition, he says something like, what he meant from the use of the word creation was something like a fashion designer making a fashion out of cloth. That he wasn't describing where the cloth came from. It was something like that. And George Gamow, by the way, for those, I think he had a lot to do with the original Big Bang. Is that right,
Professor? That's right.
I mean, I'm not sure whether he.
So the founders. So interestingly enough, the founders of the Big Bang theory in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. So George Gamow, Alexander Friedman, Georges Lemaître, these are the people who put it on its feet. They were all quite open about the idea of what actually happened at the beginning. They didn't have this idea of a creation moment. They were pretty sure they would be substituted by something else.
Yes.
The idea that it was a creation moment, it was an idea that was added to the theory more in the 50s and 60s,
right.
Essentially because of debates about steady state versus the Big Bang model.
Yes.
One of the strong opponents to the Big Bang model, Fred Hoyle, is the person who gave the theory, in fact, its name, Big Bang.
Right.
And one of the things he tried to do in those debates was sort of push the theory into a corner, which was the idea that there would have to be this moment of creation, which he thought was an unattractive feature.
Right.
Of the theory. A beginning of time was an unattractive feature, and it's still something that disturbs us and we're still uncertain about. But it was not there in the model to begin with. Most the founders had were quite open to the idea that something else might have preceded it. And George, in that quote from George Gamow, is an example of that.
Yeah, and I like to closely read, and I would recommend it that the folks that read books or articles on this topic closely read what the authors are saying, because the way, and this is just me, but the way some books are marketed, they want people to buy the book. And for example, on my bookshelf I have another book called The Moment of Creation. Well, it really isn't the moment of creation, it's really the moment after creation. It's really the moment,
yeah,
right after creation. And it, there's nothing wrong with somebody coming up with a theory of how something came from nothing. I mean, I don't fault Lawrence Krauss for trying that, and others. I think Edward Tryon, whatever his name was, tried their hand at that. But I think it's important to distinguish between what science is really saying they know and where the mystery remains. And that, I think, is very important for sort of knowing what the state of our current knowledge is, and not to mislead the public into thinking that, science has solved it all. Because we all know that science is not solved at all, and that the scientific quest is continuing. So let's now we have the big picture, we have the Big Bang. Now there are certain problems with the original Big Bang model. Is that correct?
Yes. So as originally conceived, the idea was that the universe would somehow begin, or, well, somehow there would be a beginning, or something that would, create a state of the universe initially, the universe would contain just the matter and radiation that we observe, and it would be expanding and cooling under the influence of gravity from then to the present time. And so that simple idea explains many of the observed features of the universe, but some features of the universe look quite special from that point of view and hard to explain and puzzling. So, for example, one of the things that you might expect is if the universe really did emerge in a sudden quantum event, a sudden rapid creation event, that it would be completely out of control, very uneven distribution of matter and energy. Space itself, according to general relativity, is elastic. So you might expect it would begin highly wrinkled and curved, if you can imagine space being wrinkled and curved. Then if all that happened to the universe is that it slowly expanded and cooled, what you would you'd find is that observing universe today, you should see out into this region which is highly uneven and highly curved and warped. But what we actually observe is the opposite. We observe that the universe is remarkably uniform, that we measure the average physical properties on one side of the universe or on the other side of the universe, they're the same to a very high degree of accuracy. If you look, for example, from the radiation formed when the first atoms were forming, what we call the cosmic microwave background, we find the variations in temperature when you look all around the sky are only a few parts in 100,000. So a smoother distribution of radiation than, say, if you were to rub your finger across the surface of your desk, your desk is rougher and less smooth than that distribution across the entire universe.
Wow.
Yet according to the Big Bang model, things should have been very random, and there wasn't even time for different regions to have communicated with one another at the time that light was emitted. So how should they be so much the same as when they have, why should it be so smooth, and why should they be so much the same properties from one region to another when there hasn't even been a chance for there to be sort of causal influence to cause them to smooth out? That was a key problem of the original Big Bang model. And related to that, why don't we see the effects of a strong amount of curvature, which you would typically get coming out of the Big Bang? We should observe that light, the path of light through the universe, is distorted by the fact that space is curved, but we don't observe that. What we observe is that it's as if someone smoothed the universe out and flattened the universe out so that it looks like a Euclidean universe, obeying the laws of Euclidean geometry instead of the laws of motion that you'd expect in a curved universe. How did that manage to occur? That's not at all explained within the original Big Bang picture from the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, and I think the first problem you mentioned is also known as the horizon problem.
It's related to the horizon problem. So there's several aspects to the problem. Now, the first problem is, the general problem is, why is it so smooth?
Right.
And so that could be an aspect of that is the fact that different regions of the universe haven't had a chance to communicate with one another at the time that the radiation was emitted.
Right.
So in an expanding universe, there's a limit to how far you can... In an expanding universe with a beginning, there's a limit to how far you can see because, say, if the universe is only 14 billion years old, you can only see 14 billion light years. So that doesn't mean there isn't more universe out there. It just means you're limited to how much you can see, and that's what you call your horizon. We call that the horizon. There's stuff beyond the horizon, but we can't see beyond it because we have a limited vision, limited observation point, given the finite age of the universe. Similarly, going back in time, you'd have your horizon would be less and less because there would have been even less and less time for light to have traveled. So we can draw around any point in the universe the horizon at any given time. We can take regions on opposite sides of the sky, and we can say, how big was the horizon back when that light was emitted? there, and how big was it in the other one, and do they overlap? Was there a chance for them to communicate? And in the original Big Bang model, the answer is no. There was never a chance for them to have communicated with one another. So that makes the smoothness even more puzzling. They've always been outside of each other's horizon. The horizon adds another key puzzling aspect to it. Not only how did they manage to make themselves smooth, but how could they make themselves smooth when they never even had a chance to communicate, when they were always outside of each other's horizon?
Yeah, I think one of the exciting things about cosmology, and I'm going to call it cosmology because I think that's maybe the best description, although I'm not sure if you would call yourself a cosmologist or a physicist, but maybe both. But one of the most exciting things about cosmology in my mind is that the universe is your experimental equipment or it's the Big Bang is a theory to explain this empirical reality which we call the universe. And so we look out at the universe and we see, as you say, we see uniformity in the cosmic microwave background radiation, or near uniformity. And then we see I believe there's another concept called homogeneity and isotropy.
Isotropy,
right?
Yeah.
And then we have the flatness issue, which is the curvature issue. And so to describe it in very simple terms, we have a theory of the expansion and development of the universe. It's known as the Big Bang. And then we have that theory. Then we look out at the current cosmos, and we see uniformity, which suggests something other than randomness. And then we see flatness, which suggests special conditions. And those, as I've understood it, those were two big problems with the original Big Bang theory. And I probably put it in non-technical words, but as you pointed out, when you look at the model of the Big Bang and you look at, well, what were those initial conditions? What could they have been? Well, they could have been all sorts of different initial conditions because there's nothing regulating them in the first moment. But those initial conditions had to be peculiar and precise in some way to wind up with a uniform universe and a flat universe. Right. Is that to me is.
I think that's an excellent summary. And just to add one other twist to the story about the smoothness or homogeneity, the universe is smooth and homogeneous if you look back far enough in time, or if you average over large distances, the average properties over large patches of the universe. On the other hand, it's obvious that on smaller scales, the universe is quite lumpy and non-uniform.
Right.
You know, even where you're sitting in your room and where I'm sitting in my room, it's not uniform around the room. So the what makes the puzzle even sharper is the fact that somehow it's lumpy on small scales, but then those lumps somehow begin to emerge into very smooth patches as you average over a larger and larger scale. So that adds another twist to the story.
Right, right. And those patches we also know as galaxies, right?
We have our room, we have planets, we have stars, galaxies. The galaxies form lumps. They form a cluster called galaxy clusters. The clusters form yet larger lumps called superclusters.
Right.
So things are lumpy up to that scale, and then suddenly the lumpiness ceases. There's not yet larger scale lumps. Now, as you can look on larger scales and you average over many superclusters, things begin to look smoother and smoother, and you really can't distinguish one region from the universe from the other. So it's this progression from lumpiness on the fine-grained scale to smoothness on a coarse-grained scale that has to be incorporated in your theory to explain the smoothness. You don't want to make something perfectly smooth, because then you'd never get galaxies.
Yeah.
You want to make something nearly smooth and then somehow evolve the galaxies from the slight inhomogeneities, from the slight non-uniformities that you'd have to also incorporate in your theory.
Yeah, one way I look at this is if you were developing a computer game, one of those simulated games where they simulate civilization, and there's probably one now on simulating creations of the universe, although I don't really know. But if you were doing this and you had to plug in the codes, the computer codes, into the computer in order to wind up with our current universe. In other words, you have the uniformity on the large scales, you have the clumpiness, galaxies, planets, etc. on the smaller scales. I would bet that you'd have to put a whole lot of programming knowledge, a whole lot of data into that program in order to wind up with the universe that we see at night out in the heavens. And that's sort of the way I look at it, that you're trying to figure out, well, how do we go from this primordial beginning to the place we live and see today?
So the interesting thing, Philip, is that it actually doesn't go that way. Hmm. So it turns out that the conditions you need at the start and the equations that you need to solve, and by the start I mean, let's say, at, you know, when the universe was quite young, when before the formation of atoms, to go from there to the present, the equations are simple, the codes exist, the initial conditions are extraordinarily simple. So that part of the story is very well understood. But why were those conditions so simple? Right. That's the remaining mystery. Right. How you got to those, you know, they're simple to describe, but why should they have been so simple? Because, you know, if you have a sudden quantum event, like a quantum decay event or something like that, any sort of quantum event, one of the things that characterizes quantum processes is randomness, right, unpredictability. So you should have had no predictive structure to these initial conditions. They should have been quite wild initially. And that is, we know, is wrong. They have to have been quite special, quite smooth, except for tiny inhomogeneities in order to in order for the rest of the story to follow. So it's this extraordinary simplicity that one needs to that demands a theory to explain.
Yeah, that's interesting. And on the flatness point, and the flatness issue, I think is equally remarkable. But one of the descriptions that I've read a lot about is that I guess most physicists have now concluded we live in a flat or nearly flat universe, which means that it is neither curved outward or curved inward. And for those wondering, this means that if it's curved inward, we are leading to a big crunch where the universe collapses upon itself in some kind of accelerated way. If it's an open universe, then it's going to expand forever, but eventually the galaxies, I guess, would disperse to the four winds or wherever they're going to go. But what's interesting about the flatness problem to me is that, as a matter of pure logic, a lot of science writers are basically say, well, the universe had to be pretty close to flat at the beginning, because if it wasn't, we would have already collapsed upon ourselves, or we would be seeing some kind of this accelerated, expansion, or we would have already spread out. And you know, this whole pencil point issue. I'm sure, Paul, you've heard about the whole, the universe has to sit on a pencil. If the pencil was a little off balance, it would have tilted one way or the other by now. So the interesting thing about the flatness problem to me is that it's a logical issue. Just going to the underpinnings of the theory. So now we have these problems with the Big Bang, and then something happened in the 1980s with Alan Guth, who had his spectacular realization. And why don't you tell a little bit about that? Because I know that you, in fact, attended some of his early seminars, and I'm sure you know Professor Guth, and because you've written articles with him. But why don't you tell the listeners what happened in the 80s with regard to this new inflationary model?
Sure. So, in fact, my whole reason for moving into the field of cosmology was as a result of one of the early talks that Alan Guth gave a year before his paper was published, in which he described his idea of the inflationary universe. It was one of the most exciting and depressing talks I heard, I've ever heard. Exciting because for most of the talk, it seemed like he had solved a lot of problems.
Right.
But then the last few instances, the last few minutes, he explained how there was a serious flaw in the whole idea. Hmm. And that's what drew me into the field, which was to try to address this flaw. So what Alan talked about in this talk was that it's quite possible to have conditions in the first few instances after the bang that dramatically change the history of the stretching of the universe. So originally in the Big Bang model, it was imagined that the only thing that was created, the only form of energy that existed at the beginning of the universe was in the form of matter and radiation that we observe. And one thing we know about that matter and radiation is that it gravitationally attracts itself. We used to believe that all forms of energy were gravitationally attractive, but we now know differently. But certainly the matter we normally interact with and the radiation we normally interact with is gravitationally self-attractive. So it tends to resist the expansion of the universe. Gravity tries to make the universe stretch, but the attraction of the matter tries to draw itself together, and what you get is some compromise. The universe expanding, but expanding at an ever slower rate due to this self-attraction of the energy and the matter and radiation within it. But what Alan pointed out was that it's quite simple to have forms of energy motivated, for example, by ideas in fundamental physics, in particle physics, which would have the opposite gravitational effect. They would be gravitationally self-repulsive and cause the expansion of the universe to speed up rather than slow down. And if you had a sustained period in which this was the dominant form of energy in the universe, it would create a period of hyper-accelerated expansion, which he called inflation. And what this inflation would do is take any random distribution of matter and radiation you might have had at the beginning and smooth it out. In fact, it would essentially dilute it all away, leaving only behind the energy that's driving this inflation. Similarly, if you had any wrinkles or curves or in space itself, if you think about stretching it very fast, taking a rubbery sheet which is curved and wrinkled and stretching it very fast, it would become extraordinarily flat. So this hyper-accelerated expansion or inflation would both smooth and flatten, the two key conditions that you wanted. And then if after all that smoothing and flattening, you could imagine ending this process by converting that energy now, having it decay in some way into ordinary matter and radiation, you would now have a universe full of your matter and radiation that you wanted, but now with the very special smooth and flat conditions that you couldn't explain before. So that was the exciting idea. The disappointing thing is that he proved or thought he proved that you could never have this decay process, that you could have your inflation, but you could never get the inflation to end. And so the last few minutes he gave that part of the argument, and that was the depressing part. So at the end of the talk, I remember just sitting in the room. I didn't get out of my chair, just feeling, you know, my head was like bursting with, here was this really exciting idea that seemed to explain a lot of important fundamental properties of the universe. It's a beautiful idea, but then somehow it fails. There must be a way to save this. And that's how I got into the field. And a year or so later, my student, after I'd moved to the University of Pennsylvania, my student Andy Albrecht and I, and independently Andre Linde in the Soviet Union, in the then Soviet Union, proposed a way out that allowed you to have your inflation and have it do what you wanted, decay into matter and radiation. So you could, in principle, make the scenario work. And that became, so the original idea was called old inflation. That's the one that failed. New inflation is the idea that has succeeded and is essentially the model on which all subsequent Big Bang inflationary models are built.
Now, can you try to, and this might be a somewhat of an unfair question, but could you try to explain in the simplest possible terms what the difference is between the old and the new inflation, because you mentioned one of the problems with the original inflation model was stopping inflation, was slowing
yes.
it down. So what is the is there like an example you give your students or your first years or whatever to help them get their heads around this new, you know, the new inflation twist?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure it'll be simple, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
So physics students have the advantage that they've taken some courses and they know about some processes in solid state physics and condensed matter physics that the general public would not. And you can use those as examples. But let me try. Okay. So what Alan tried to propose was an idea which was drawn from an analogy with a phase transition, like the one that would occur, for example, if you were trying to convert water into ice. So you might normally think that all you do to convert water into ice is you just lower the temperature, and then suddenly the whole thing turns solid. But if you look in detail, it's a little bit more complicated than that, more subtle than that. What will happen is as you're cooling the liquid, that you can actually cool it, if it's pure enough water, below what you think would be the freezing temperature. Hmm. Because there's an energy barrier that prevents the water from turning into ice. If you can get some of the water to cross that barrier, it'll solidify. But it needs a little energy boost, if you like, to cross the barrier to get into the ice phase. Okay. This process is known as supercooling. The idea that you can cool below the freezing temperature this way.
Okay.
So the idea that Alan had would be that there would be something analogous to that happening in the universe. There'd be a phase transition, this time associated with the properties associated with fields that are predicted to exist in elementary particle physics that would permeate the universe. There'd be a change in the phase of those fields, which would be like freezing. And there'd be an energy barrier, though, that would keep you in the original phase for as you supercooled. And while you supercool and you're in this phase, there's an energy associated with it, which he showed would have the property that would be one of those forms of energy which has the property that is gravitationally self-repulsive and would cause the expansion of the universe to accelerate. So as long as you were supercooling, you got your acceleration.
Wow.
Now, in the case of water to ice, if I continue to cool the system, eventually there'll be some random fluctuation which will create a little crystallite, and maybe another crystallite in another place in the liquid, another one in another place in the liquid. And once those form, they will grow very rapidly and solidify the entire system. Hmm. So can that happen in the universe? Well, that was the hang-up with Goof's idea. In this case, unlike the case of the water, the regions that are supercooling are expanding at an extraordinary rate. And so even if you manage to form a fluctuation that would carry you over the barrier into the frozen-like phase, that region could never grow fast enough to outrun the expansion of the universe that was still supercooling. Hmm. So you form little crystallite regions, if you like, regions that would finish inflating, but they would never have a chance to join together to complete the phase transition.
Okay.
And inside them, there would not be enough matter and energy to form galaxies and stars. So you've started the process, but once you started it, the inflation was so powerful, it prevented the inflation from ending.
Okay.
That was the old inflationary idea. And then what Andy Albrecht and Andre Lindy and I showed was that there's other kinds of phase transitions which you don't require this energy barrier. So in this case, you could have your inflation. It would sustain itself for a finite period of time, which is what you wanted, and then it seemed at the time that it would complete. It would complete over very large regions and lead to those regions being full of matter and radiation. And so they would produce all the conditions you wanted to have in the post-inflationary universe.
I see. One of the mysteries of cosmology to me is understanding what additional assumptions or fields or whatever, values, are being added to the theory. One of the mysteries in my mind in the inflationary theory, and I'm not sure if this is old, new, or both, is this thing called the inflaton field, which is hard to grasp because it looks like a typo for inflation when you see it, but I think it is inflaton field. And
yeah, we put normally it's supposed to remind you of electron, so it's supposed to be inflaton. So it normally be pronounced inflaton.
Okay, inflaton.
Which is just a stand-in for a field to be named later.
Okay. Now is the inflaton field? Is this a field that exists that theoretically existed at the time of inflation and then disappeared? Or is that one of the problems?
It would be a field that would not only have existed then, but it would come to dominate the energy of the universe. It would be the dominant form of energy of the universe during inflation. After inflation's over, when you say disappeared, what that really means is it would convert almost all of its energy into matter and radiation, leaving such a negligible amount left in the form of this field that you wouldn't be able to detect it today. So it's not that it wouldn't be here today necessarily, but just it would have no important cosmological effect and wouldn't be detectable in the laboratory. It may not be detectable in the laboratory.
Okay, and so this is what's important to me in very basic terms, and that is, at some point in the mid-20th century or so, there was the Big Bang theory was created. And the Big Bang theory, as Professor Steinhardt has said, came to be an explanation for the expansion, cooling, development of the universe. Then there were problems noticed in the original Big Bang model in explaining the fine-tuning or the special conditions under which we seem to live in, including the homogeneity of the universe and the flat Euclidean geometry. Then Alan Guth had a spectacular realization, which is what he called it in his book called The Inflationary Big Bang, and came up with a theory to explain the smoothness and the flatness problem. And then you and your colleagues developed this new inflationary model, which helped deal with some of the problems with the original inflationary model. But the key thing I want to say here is that if you read the modern science textbooks, and I have one called The Cosmos by Alex Filipenko and this other gentleman from, I believe, a California university. When you read the modern cosmology physics textbooks, they will talk about the inflationary Big Bang. The old Big Bang, the original Big Bang, seems to be part of science history right now. And so it's important for the listener to understand that we're living in the inflationary Big Bang era right now in terms of what is being taught in the schools. It's not really the Big Bang anymore. And so now I assume that is correct, because I know that every time when you read a modern science article, and as I said, these textbooks, the inflationary Big Bang is really the leading theory. And I think you even say it in your article that it really is the textbook explanation right now. Is that right, Professor?
I think that's fair, Philip. That doesn't mean that it can't be replaced.
Right.
But I think what you said is a fair characterization of the present state of affairs. As we may talk about, there are reasons to be concerned about it. But that is the current state of affairs.
Right, and this is where we move to the next step, and this is why we're at a exciting stage of cosmology. Not only for this reason, but for all sorts of reasons, and we're not going to get into the God particle and dark matter and all those other things. But. In your article, in your April 11, 2011 Scientific American article, which I would highly recommend folks to read as a backup to this interview, you come out and you, I think, take an objective view of where cosmology is with the inflationary Big Bang, and you point out that there's problems with the inflationary Big Bang model, right? That's what.
Yes.
And why don't we now move to the next stage here, and maybe you could identify some of the issues, problems with the inflationary Big Bang model.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me mention one further success that we didn't talk about that'll be important for, because it's also the place where the trouble begins as well.
Okay.
So we've explained how we got the inflation, even beginning with Goose Idea. I mentioned that Goose Idea failed because he couldn't figure out how to end the inflation over any sizable patch and leave any matter and radiation behind. The work that was done by my colleagues and myself to show how you could end it allowed us to do something else, which was then compute what exactly the conditions would be like at the very end, after you were through with this process. And so now we can say how it ends. We can actually now begin to describe in more detail what the end condition is like. What we discovered was that if you include the effects of quantum physics, you don't get a perfectly smooth and flat universe. You get a universe which is nearly smooth and flat. Because of quantum physics being inherently unpredictable, the way the inflaton energy, the energy in this that was driving inflation, the way it would decay would be through a quantum process which wouldn't occur at exactly the same time in one place in space compared to another. In the same way that if I have a bunch of uranium atoms, I know there's a certain half-life to those atoms, but there'll be quite a bit of variation when one nucleus decays versus another. There's an inherent unpredictability to any kind of quantum decay process, whether it be uranium atoms or decay of the inflaton energy. And at first, that seemed to be a good thing. Why is it a good thing? Well, because we don't want a universe which is perfectly smooth. We said at the outset we want a certain level of lumpiness so that we can eventually form galaxies from the slight non-uniformities that would be there. And when we computed, a number of us computed what the quantum effects would be on the slight advances and delays in the end of inflation, when we computed what that would produce in the distribution of matter and radiation, it turned out to produce a very special distribution of non-uniformities, a special distribution of variations in temperature and density that matched up well with what theorists had supposed might have to be there by reverse engineering, by taking the present conditions of the universe and extrapolating back and say, what do we need in principle? What was coming out of inflation seemed to match beautifully with what that reverse engineering approach was telling us.
Okay.
And this is considered one of the great successes of inflation. It led to a prediction of how galaxies got seeded, from which we could then operate those computer programs we were talking about before and say, okay, given that plus gravity, can we explain the distribution of galaxies we see today? The answer is yes. Could we explain the radiation we see in the microwave background up to the present point? Beautifully, yes. And so it seems to, you know, if you were to ask most astrophysicists and cosmologists today, you know, not just do you believe inflation, but why, they would point beyond the smoothness and flatness to now what we know about the formation and distribution of galaxies, and especially from this radiation from the cosmic microwave background, as verifying the predictions of inflation. So those are extraordinary successes, which one has to also keep in mind when one's judging this theory.
That's good.
But quantum physics, once you've let it in the door, and you must because we believe it's part of fundamental physics, will do what it wants. And it turns out there's something else you get for your quantum physics, which in my view is potential disaster for the theory. And the problem here is that when we said inflation ended every place by with this new inflationary idea, what we were really doing was taking a naive, average guess, if you like, as to when it would take, how long it would take things to end inflation. Looking at it more closely, if you have some sort of quantum process, like with the uranium atoms, or in the case of the inflationary energy, in addition to there being regions which might end inflation slightly earlier than average and slightly later than average, there's inevitably can also be regions that end inflation much, much later than average. So I'll call these regions sluggard regions, regions that didn't end when they were supposed to, but due to random quantum effects, they're going to stay behind, and they're going to stay behind not decaying. Most of the space has decayed. Well, you naively would think most of the cases is decayed. So similarly, if I had a block of uranium atoms, I can wait a long time, and maybe most of them have decayed, but some of them will not have decayed. Hmm. Okay, now, in the case of the uranium atoms, at a certain point you don't care because there's so few that haven't decayed, you don't care about them. They contribute an insignificant amount to radiation. But in the case of inflation, you can't ignore those sluggard regions because they're inflating. Gravity is rewarding them by giving them huge amounts of volume. In a matter of instance, they actually occupy more volume than the region that, if you like, was the non-sluggards, the regions that made it downhill when you thought, completed the transition when you thought. So instead of the picture that you initially thought you had, where almost everywhere has ended inflation, except there may be a few rare regions that haven't, what really happens in a matter of instance is that those rare regions occupy most of the volume, and the region that has now become a tiny island in an otherwise inflating region dominated by these sluggards. So in other words, inflation has had an effect, an unintended effect of amplifying these very rare fluctuations which you didn't want. You wanted the regions which were typical, but inflation has stretched those regions that you didn't want, that they are actually most of the universe. And furthermore, that means that this process continues. Those regions that were sluggard regions, which are still inflating, they're still, just like uranium atoms, you just wait longer, they'll eventually be some decaying. They will again attempt to decay. You'll produce another island, but it'll always be the rare regions left behind that continue to dominate most of the universe. So what you end up with is a universe which isn't everywhere like we observe, but rather only has islands of space, which we observe separated by huge expanses of inflating universe.
So this is
sometimes called the multiverse.
Okay.
That's right. You're going to go ahead.
No, I was going to say that from your article, I see in very basic terms one of the problems with the inflationary model right now is that the inflationary model was designed to address the problem of the fine tuning of the initial conditions in the original Big Bang. That the original Big Bang required precise initial conditions to get at to explain the flat universe, to explain the smoothness, and to explain the inhole, the galaxies and the large scale structure of the universe. Now it seems as if we're saying that in order to get the type of inflation to fix those problems and to wind up at the universe we see, now we need a finely tuned inflationary model.
Well, it's worse than that. The effect I'm talking about, when you have this eternal inflation with only islands of universe which end inflation, is essentially an inevitable consequence of inflation.
Of any inflation.
Within these islands, it would be okay if it were the case that all these islands had the fine-tuned conditions like we observe.
Right.
Then we would say, okay, we just live inside one of those islands.
Right.
And that's often what is said. Right. But the problem is, again, there's another unintended consequence once the quantum effects are fully taken into account. These different sluggard regions are not all the same. So when they decay, they don't actually produce the same conditions in these islands. You get all variants of cosmological conditions inside those islands. So what you thought when you were naive before and not thinking about this eternal runaway, this eternal inflation, as we call it, what you thought was going to be the consequence of your model of producing the conditions which you thought you wanted at the beginning, you actually get islands, an infinite variety of islands with an infinite variety of possibilities, an infinite number of which might have the conditions you want, but an infinite number of which do not.
Wow.
So you end up with a picture which is now unpredictive in the sense that, as Alan Guth described it, you know, if you consider all these different islands, anything can happen and will happen over time an infinite number of times, so that there is nothing you can observe about your present universe that is unique and that tells you this picture is correct.
So are you saying under any scenario where the inflationary theory is used, you're going to wind up with this problem of really having nothing to put your finger on? I mean, when you say an infinite variety, and you use a good example in your article about the coins in the jar, what I'm getting from that is that it's forever unpredictable. It's forever you can't nail it down. It's unknowable.
According to our current understanding of inflation, that's the situation. So it needs a cure, or you need a different idea.
Okay, so now...
And that's what I would say. I mean, I should say. So at this point, cosmologists begin to split in their points of view.
Okay,
you'd have some cosmologists who would say, as long as there's some regions of the universe that look like us, I'm willing to be satisfied. I don't care if it's not predicted. As long as they're there in the universe someplace, I'm satisfied. I very much disagree with that point of view. I think it's way too low a standard.
Yes.
Because if you're going to admit that idea, then you didn't need inflation in the first place. You could have said the Big Bang without inflation may occur. If it occurred once, it could have occurred many independent times. And one of them could be us.
Okay.
And was I satisfied with that? No, because I thought, well, but those conditions seem to be quite odd and strange and special.
Right.
The same applies to the inflationary case. You can say it occurs, but the fact that it's not picked out as being preferred, it's a serious criticism of the model. It requires a cure or a replacement.
You know, one of the principles that I, you know, in my own mind that I get when I read about the inflationary model and the Big Bang is that it seems that the more adjustments that are made in the theory, the greater the difficulty in explaining the source of the adjustments. Or put differently, the more complicated the theory, the more parameters you need to adjust, the harder it is to figure out why those parameters are necessary. Because I remember, was it Einstein or one of the founders of modern physics, who said something like, you know, he wants to know why the universe is the way it is, or you know, why the old one did it the way he did it, and then you have Leon Letterman in his book The God Particle, who said something like, the quest of science is to put the final theory in an equation small enough to fit on a T-shirt. Because the simpler theories are easier to explain, and I think they're easier to prove, and that's one of my issues with some of the theories is that it seems to me that we need to focus on simplifying rather than making them more complex. But it's just my own prejudice, I guess.
Well, I don't think it's just your prejudice, Philip. I think it is the correct scientific prejudice. It is one of the guiding principles we use all the time.
Yes.
But at the moment, inflation is in this very peculiar state in which when you talk to different scientists about it, they'll respond depending upon what their interest is in very different ways. So if you ask most astronomers about the problem we just described with this eternal runaway,
right,
they'll say, oh, yeah, I heard something about that, but I'm going to assume that theorists will solve that problem someday.
Yes.
Because what impresses me, they would say, is that the predictions that were developed in the early 1980s seem to agree with what we observe.
Right.
Now, the problem is that those predictions in the early 1980s didn't take account of this eternal runaway.
Yeah.
It wasn't realized it wasn't appreciated that inflation amplifies these rare fluctuations. So what they were calling predictions I would say today, you really can't justify them as predictions.
Yes.
But the astronomers will say, I don't care about it. Then there'll be a certain community that says, like I said, okay, maybe I should be satisfied with a theory where at least there's some probability or some chance of my, you know, what we observe being there. I don't care if I can't predict it or how small it is. And there I would say, well, that's just too low a standard.
Yes.
And then there's some of them, like me, who would say, no, this problem has to be solved, or we have to either fix it or replace. And I'm very insistent in my view that you have to fix or replace. The present situation cannot remain. You cannot defend this theory in its present present condition.
It seems to me that time and this would be both experiments, data, observations, logic, critiques. Time ultimately finds the best theory, and I'm not a big fan of folks. It's not just scientists, but it's people in general who circle the wagons around a unfinished theory, and say, you know, this is it. It happens probably more in non-scientific fields than any others. So I was gonna end this show by saying that this is a hallmark of science, where, and I think that that you, Professor, are really setting a great example of true science. And I'm not just saying this because you're a guest on the show, but I thought that somebody needs to look objectively at the state of some of these theories and do some self-critical analysis, because you're never going to find the right theory unless you continue to criticize the old ones and refine them. And we're sort of out of time, but I know that you have your own thoughts on where cosmology should be going. So why don't you summarize where you think cosmology should be going with this? I know you've written a book on this topic, and you have your own thoughts, but what do you think the next step is? If you had to decide, what would be the next step here to deal with this inflationary Big Bang problem?
That's a good question. So to me, the critical issue has to do with the Big Bang itself. The question we asked talked about the beginning, talked about the start of the show, which is, you know, what happened at the beginning, or was there a beginning? So the problem we've gotten into with inflation began with a logic, or began with an assumption that the Big Bang really is the start point for the universe. You can't talk about times previous to it. You can only talk about time since it. And furthermore, that this sudden creation. Those combinations of assumptions, unproven assumptions, are what forced us to this fine-tuning problem, and then inflation led to this eternal runaway. So if I were going to challenge something, I'd go back to that assumption and say, well, suppose it's not the case. Suppose the Big Bang is some sort of, I'll call it a bounce or a transition between some pre-phase and some post-phase.
Right.
For example, it could be a contraction leading to an expansion. That's not such a radical idea. Going back to the 20s and 30s, that actually is what many of the founding fathers of the Big Bang actually had in mind the Big Bang is being. It's just that we haven't explored it as much in recent years.
Right.
If you allow that possibility, it turns out it opens up a whole new set of ways of solving the same fine-tuning problems that inflation was designed to solve. For example, you discussed the horizon problem with me, the fact that different parts of the universe didn't have time to be in causal contact with one another. That was assuming the Big Bang was time equals zero, and there was no previous time. But if time existed before, there's plenty of time for things to come in causal contact.
Hmm.
You immediately eliminate that problem.
Yes.
It turns out a phase of contraction automatically flattens the universe. So if you have a long enough phase of contraction prior to the bang, prior to T, what we normally think of as the beginning, if there's a long enough phase of contraction, you already start out with a universe which is extraordinarily flat enough, it can be made flat enough that it would still seem flat today.
I see.
So you start off, and then it turns out you can add other ideas to this, where you could explain the fluctuations in density and temperature we see so far in the microwave background. And you can even go one stage further and show that it's conceivable, possible, that this bang would not be a one-time event, but could repeat at regular intervals, say a trillion years or so. And so that we would be, in this story, in the midst of a cyclic, never-ending universe, never-ending in time. or space, a universe would go through cycles of expansion, of creation of matter and radiation, which is what we would call the Big Bang, expansion and cooling, eventually leading to acceleration. The acceleration decays into contraction. The contraction leads to the next Big Bang, and then the process would repeat. So all this becomes possible and can be made consistent with we observe to the same degree that the naive version of inflation is consistent with what we observe.
Go ahead. I was going to say.
So I think these are two interesting competing ideas, and they give, what's interesting about them is that although they agree up to this point with everything we currently observe, they disagree about the things we are next going to try to observe. So we're at a point in the history of cosmology where the observations of the next few years could help us distinguish between these two very different possibilities for the history of the universe. Big Bang as a beginning, or Big Bang as bounce and possible endless universe.
So I take it that topic is addressed in your book that you did with Neil Turok.
Yeah, so we discuss both the conventional, both the Big Bang inflationary theory, and we discuss this alternative. I think what we've learned since that book was written is more about the problems of inflation. So the Scientific American article is a little bit more up to date in terms of the criticisms of inflation. Right. But the book describes both these competing ideas and how to distinguish them.
Right. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for your time. I hope that most people stayed for this whole ride through the Big Bang and the inflationary Big Bang and beyond, because the question about how it all began is the biggest question out there. And I think that what we are seeing in modern cosmology is science at work, particularly if it's practiced by those like Professor Steinhardt, where science is continuing to re-examine its theories and trying to match up the theories with what is occurring in the outside cosmos. And we might add that this is contrary to other belief systems that do not engage in this radical self-criticism. So, Professor, I'd like to thank you very much for your time. I'm going to try to convince you to come back in a couple weeks or months and follow up with maybe on the multiverse. But I thought this was very educational. I want to recommend folks just pick up the April 11, 2011 issue of Scientific American. I'm sure it's available online in some form, and there's references in there for related topics on the inflationary Big Bang. This is a big question. It's still unresolved, and there is still mystery that we will have to spend a lot of time trying to resolve. So this is Philip Mirton. This is Conversations Beyond Science and Religion. Thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to Conversations Beyond Science and Religion with Philip Mirton. To find out more about Philip and his new book, The Heaven at the End of Science, visit heaven@theendofscience.com.